And remember, he wrestled all night. We talked about that. I would say Jacob now is much more confident than he had been. He's been blessed by the one he believes is God, and I believe that's true. But still, he might have some fear. And we see Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and there was Esau coming. And it wasn't just Esau. There were 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two handmaids. Now, I say, you know, he might have had some fear, but it might have been a matter of, well, I'm going to get ready to introduce my family, and I'm going to have it organized by, you know, the mothers with their children. And, of course, he puts the maidservants and their children in front, Leah and her children behind, Rachel and Joseph last. Like his parents, he's not too bashful about showing favoritism, which is going to cause trouble among his children, just like it caused trouble between he and Esau. Let's also give, I want to give Jacob some credit, because he's been a bit fearful. He's done some bad things in the past. But one thing we don't see here is any consideration that he ever thought of running and hiding. I want to give him credit. He's afraid Esau's going to come and attack, and he takes proper measures that everybody won't be wiped out. But he doesn't try to run. He doesn't try to hide. He's right out there. And, of course, it goes on that way. He put the maidservants, Rachel and Joseph, last. Verse 3, then he crossed over before them. So he went out in front of them, bowed himself to the ground 7 times, and came near his brothers. So he's showing great humiliation and deference. And Esau ran to meet him, embraced him, and fell on his neck and kissed him. So, and again, I'm sure this is a paternal type kiss. But it shows that the years of separation have blunted Esau's anger. Not only years of separation, but we'll learn later, Esau has become wealthy and influential, which goes a long way to not being so upset about not getting that special blessing. And, you know, remember, they're twins. They've been separated for 20 years. We can remember, again, some will look at the story and say, yeah, maybe Esau was coming with 400 warriors intending to do harm. And then when he saw his brother, emotion got the best of him and he changed his mind. That, you know, the text leaves room for that possibility, but I still tend to lean towards, no, he didn't think so. You know, it seems that he all along wanted to honor Jacob and renew their relationship. Of course, one of the first things he asks is, I got ahead of myself. He lifted his eyes, saw the women and children. So the first thing he asks is, who's this? Well, these are the children God has graciously given his servant. And they come forward and they bow. So he presents them. Then Esau says, what do you mean by all this company I meant? You know, what's with all the animals coming here? This would have to be asking for confirmation, because remember, Jacob had told the servants to say, this is a gift for Esau from Jacob, and he's coming behind us. So Esau had been told several times that these are a gift. At first he says, no, I don't need it. I got plenty. Well, Jacob says, well, go ahead, please take it, because I've got plenty. And from what I've read, in that culture, for someone of a superior status to accept a gift from someone of an inferior status, and the reason I say that is because Esau was the firstborn, so he had superior status in that sense. So for him to accept that gift was a sign of lasting friendship. You know, it meant something more than just, okay, I'll take it. It was symbolic of, hey, we're on good terms now. We're going to be friends. All the animosity of the past is behind us. So with that said, verse 12, Esau says, let's go. You can imagine the personality difference. Let's get up and let's get out of here. Yeah, you know, you come riding in with a cloud of dust and all these people. Jacob has different thoughts. Jacob says, oh, my Lord knows the children are weak and the flocks and herds are nursing. If men would drive them hard one day, all the flock would die. Please let my Lord go. And Lord means my boss, or it's another way it's the equivalent of us saying, sir. Please, sir, go ahead. He's not equating him with God in any way. So we see capital L-O-R-D, it's not that. But he is showing great deference. My sister never called me Lord, you know, and I don't expect she ever will, nor boss or sir, I think. She's called me a lot of things. What I'm making the point is Jacob's showing this deference, and he's also showing common sense. Jacob realizes that our personality differences and our differences of habits would make it a bad idea for us to do a road trip together. I mean, I know if you have siblings like that, you probably have friends who you're fine hanging out together, but you don't want to get in a car and go to California together. You know, it's a, some people would be great, some people not great. So Jacob realizes, so I mean, you're getting ready to start a road trip. Hopefully you won't learn the hard way. So anyways, Esau agrees, but Esau says, verse 15, let me leave some of the people with me. Jacob, what need is there? Let me find favor. So, you know, we don't need that. Just go ahead. Now, at the end of verse 14, it said, until I come to my Lord in Seir, he indicates that he's planning to come visit Esau at his home. But from what we read in the scripture, there's no indication that he ever did. So maybe he did and it wasn't recorded. It didn't seem important enough, or maybe he just never did. We will see later in chapter 36, verse 5, that Esau moved back to Canaan. So remember, they're down here. Esau, by chapter 36, is back up in this area. And at the same time, Israel, Jacob, is there. We think, because Isaac was nearing the end of his life, that Esau came and Jacob came, and they spent Isaac's last years with him, perhaps helping to take care of him and such. That's moving ahead, but I wanted to make the point here. Jacob says something that we never see being fulfilled. It's not necessary that he was lying. He just might not have been able to follow through the way he intended. Or possibly he did follow through and we just don't read about it. At any rate, Esau returns. So they had this nice reunion. They're happy. They hugged and wept. And Esau goes on his way. Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built himself a house and made booths there for his livestock. That's why the name of the place is Succoth. Succoth means booth, as you probably know, because it's the same word from which we get the term Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Succoth, temporary shelters made of whatever. And this is his first stopping point in Canaan. And probably later on, then a town there is named Succoth. I'm not seeing it on this map, but we believe it's up in this area. He's not going to stay there a long time, because we'll see then in verse 18... I should change the page, see if I'm overlooking something. No. He came safely to the city of Shechem. My edition of the Bible has got a note there by safely, because the word there is the root word for peace, which is shalom. And some scholars believe that actually that was a proper name for a place that he came to on his way to Shechem. And to me, that's a bit of Bible trivia, but since we're doing a college-level class, I'll share that with you. Either way, whether it's a place named safely or peace, or that he came in peace, you know, he did come in peace and safety. To the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram. Paddan Aram was a way of referring back to Mesopotamia. And Shechem is marked on this map, they believe, is about here. So, you know, it's up in the hill country, nice area, apparently a small village, as we're going to see. And he bought a parcel of land, which on where he pitched his tent. And he bought it from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. Apparently, this seems to be, aside from the burial plot that Abraham bought after Sarah died, the first piece of land that any of the Israelites owned in the Promised Land. So, for the most part, all of Abraham's life, all of Isaac's life, they've been wandering, been pilgrims, sojourners. Now, Jacob buys a piece of land. We don't know how big it is, but he'll stay there for a little while. And he built an altar there and called it El Elohe Israel, God, the God of Israel. Notice he not only uses his God-given name, Israel, he's calling himself Israel. So he's calling God his own. He's referring to the God of Israel himself. I'm pausing there to mention that because Jacob perhaps has completed his spiritual journey, or at least reached a turning point of being this selfish, conniving person who tries to get things in his own way and doesn't know God very well. Remember when he's on his way to Haran to find a wife, and he has this dream, and he's like, God is here, and I didn't even know it. I better anoint this pillar. This is God's house. It seems that he had a limited view of God then. He's got a much better view of God now. And he's probably Well, I've seen speculations that he's anywhere from his 60s to his 80s or 90s. So part of me says, hopefully we're well along in our spiritual journey at a sooner or faster rate than Jacob was. Okay, I wanted to comment on that. One other thing I overlooked, this town of Shechem, which seems to, it's synonymous. We'll see a person named Shechem and a town named Shechem. This might be the same that in John chapter 4 is called Sychar. There it's spelled S-Y-C-H-A-R. That's John 4 verses 5 and 6. I'm mentioning this because that's where Jesus sat and sat down at a well and had a talk with a Samaritan woman. And she makes a reference to a well that was given by Jacob to his son. And so it makes us think, oh, maybe this is where Jacob lived for some time. So you up with me on this? I'm trying not to rush too far or too fast. Because we're moving ahead in the next chapter, we see Dinah has her story. Not a good story, but Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she'd born to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. Some time, we believe, has passed here. Some believe as many as 7 years, although we don't know. So Jacob and his family might have been there a number of years at least. Hannah, you had a... Sychar? That might be another name for Shechem. So in John 4, we see a town called Sychar, and that's where Jesus talks to the Samaritan woman and said, you know, basically asked her for a drink, and she says, oh, you're a Jew. How come you're talking to me? He says, well, if you knew who I was, you'd ask me to give you water, you know, living water. So that might have been this particular spot that had family connections. So I'm just bringing it up as something that's not certain, but could be. Okay, the idea that some time has passed here is important, perhaps, because we don't know exactly how old Dinah is. I've seen some speculations that she may have been like 14 or 15 years old or maybe slightly older. I mentioned before, we don't know for certain that she had no sisters. There's one scripture that could be taken as a slight indication that she might, but from everything we've read, she's the only girl. There might be servant girls and such in the company, but she doesn't have any siblings that are girls from what we read. So part of the thought is she goes out, it says she went out to see the daughters of the land. Maybe she'd like to have some friends her own age, hang out and meet people. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and violated her. Not very good. His soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman and spoke kindly to the young woman. There's different views of what might have happened here. One, at one extreme, is that he saw her and grabbed her and forcibly raped her, which is a terrible thought. Some have speculated, and one of the reasons I mention this is Josephus's historical account says a bit more about this. He's the one that says that she was about 15 years old, and they'd been there 7 years. And Josephus says there was a public festival going on, like, say, a county fair, and people are roaming around. She goes to meet the daughters. And that leads to speculation that she met Shechem and they hung out, he sweet-talked her, maybe some alcohol was involved, and one thing led to another. Either case is not good. You know, it's bad and evil is involved either way, but they can portray a different way of getting there. But there's one thought, if it happened that way, it could be, okay, I do want to marry this girl, which is, I don't know, preferable to the first version. Keep in mind at this point, verse 4, Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, get me this young woman as wife. Jacob heard that he defiled Dinah, his daughter. His sons were the livestock in the field, so Jacob held his peace. How did Jacob hear about this? Not from Dinah coming back and telling him. Near the end of the story, in verse 26, it shows that Dinah was still in Shechem's house. And the brothers, when they go in and wreak this havoc, take her with her. So probably Jacob heard the story when Hamor contacted him saying, hey, you know, we've got your daughter, my son wants to marry her, let's work out a deal, we can talk about a dowry and things like that. Perhaps, I'm speculating a bit. Of course, Jacob holds his peace, waiting for his sons who are adults to come in. Jacob's not this feeble old man at this point, but he wants to consult with the sons, partly because this could become a major family agreement and financial transaction. You say that's a, really? What? I mean, well, that's one thing that leads me to think it might have been less than just an attack and a rape, because in that case, you'd think Jacob and the sons would go charging in with swords. If it's a matter of, hey, they got together and one thing led to another, but he wants to marry her, you know, considering that Jacob, we learned at the end of the previous chapter, had bought land from Hamor, maybe they have a relationship, at least they've done business together. And there's indication Jacob might be ready to entertain the thought of letting Dinah marry this fellow. So we're waiting to see what happens. Verse 7, the sons of Jacob come in from the field when they heard it. They were grieved and very angry because he'd done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing which ought not to be done. And that is very accurately written. Some things like that should not happen. Hamor spoke with them, though, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him as wife and make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us, take our daughters to you. So you'll dwell with us and the land will be before you. Dwell and trade and acquire possessions." Shechem is saying, let's merge and become one people. That term will appear later in the chapter. Look, let's intermarry. Let's get along together. Okay. Verse 11, Shechem said to the father and brothers, "Let me find favor in your eyes." So we've seen Hamor speaking, but Shechem is there. And I can imagine the brothers are looking at him with death in their eyes, probably. But they're holding off. They're not whipping out the swords and fighting now. But he's saying, ask ever so much dowry. Name your price, but give me this young woman as wife. Well, they're thinking of something that's not money. The sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor and spoke deceitfully because he defiled Dinah. They said, "We can't do this thing to give our sister to one who's uncircumcised. That would be a reproach to us. Okay, on this condition, we'll consent to you." And they're making the case not just consent to this one marriage, but for us to dwell together and intermix socially and become one people. "If you will become like we are, if every male of you is circumcised, then we'll give our daughters plural, to you, and we'll take your daughters to us, we'll dwell with you, and we'll become one people. But if you won't heed us and be circumcised, we'll take our daughter and be gone." Okay, so it says that they were speaking, you know, deceitfully. So it's interesting, you know, it doesn't seem that they're proposing, "We're going to teach you how to worship the true God properly." They just want to get them to mutilate themselves, if you want to call it that, but go through circumcision so they're going to be weak and susceptible to attack. And we know that from what happens later and from the fact that it says they acted deceitfully. It's worth noting, we could say maybe not Shechem, but Hamor, the father, seems to be acting honorably. You know, he didn't do anything wrong, his son did, and it seems he's saying, hey, let's work this out. And we'll see them, when they agree to this, they follow through and obey, you know, and the sons of Israel don't. Yeah, Emily?
What about Jacob and all this? Did he not
have... Well, he's there. He seems to be letting his sons take the lead. For whatever reason, maybe he's thinking he's biased. It's a good question. I was going to make the point, Jacob's not old and senile, but he is up there in years. One of the reasons I say he's not too old and senile, in the next chapter we're going to see he has another son. Yeah, Dr. Britt? I believe that's what it says, yeah.
Yeah, so it says Jacob's sons.
Yeah, verse 13, the sons of Jacob answered...
Right.
Hamor, his father, spoke deceitfully.
So even though he was there, he might have, like you said, he was letting them take the lead in this negotiation. So maybe Jacob was also deceived by them, so he didn't necessarily know the sons were going to turn around and do this.
Yeah, good thing to mention, because he's not happy at what happens later because of the deceit. So Jacob is upset, saying, "What have you done? You've brought reproach. We're in danger." So yeah, you get the idea, particularly Simeon and Levi and maybe the other brothers plot this out, and Jacob doesn't seem to be in the know or responsible for it. And I was just making the point, we see a pretty brief account, and there's more things maybe to think about and consider. As I said, it's not to say that, oh, you know, what happened between Shechem and Dinah was okay, and you don't want to say all's well that ends well, but You know, things could have gone much better. I was going to make a reference to a law that would be given to Israel later. It's in Exodus 22, verses 16 and 17. In Exodus 22, verses 16 and 17, it says that in a case like this, where a man, you know, either seduces a young woman or rapes her, he has to pay the dowry to the father, whether or not the father lets them marry. I find that interesting, because it basically says if this man finds a woman and lies with her, he has to give the bride price and marry her. And if the father won't let her marry him, he still has to pay the bride price. So, and we'll discuss that later. Now, that hadn't been codified and given to Israel before, but there seems to be a principle that God had in mind. And at the end of verse 19... Actually, it's in verse 17, where the sons of Jacob said, "If you will not heed us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and be gone." It seems that they believed they had enough strength of arms to go in there and forcibly remove Dinah. In other words, they thought, hey, we can take you guys. And it seems that the people of the city of Shechem didn't disagree with them. They didn't say, yeah, go ahead and try it. And you think if Shechem was much more powerful, they wouldn't have even given consideration to all our males have to be circumcised. So the idea is this is a small village, and the Israelites now are a sizable clan with a fair bit of manpower and wealth. But we see Hamor and Shechem and his son came to the gate of their city. Here again we see the gate of the city as a place where government and business is done. And they spoke with the men. And they said, well, these men are at peace with us. And remember, they might have been there for some years. They've gotten along. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade in it. The land is large enough for us, for them. Let us take their daughters to us as wives. Let us give them our daughters. But, now comes the fine print. Only on this condition will the men consent to dwell with us and be one people. Every male among us is to be circumcised as they are circumcised. One thing I always wonder, there's no record of anybody saying, what's circumcision? Can you explain that to me? I don't know if it's just not in the record or if it's something that was commonly known, because you expect the men of the city are saying, you want me to do what? So that your son can marry this girl? But they make the case that this is going to enrich all of us. As it says in verse 23, will not their livestock and their property and every animal of theirs be ours? Let us consent with them and they'll dwell with us. And they make a convincing argument, apparently. It says, all who went to the gate of the city heeded Hamor and Shechem his son. Every male was circumcised, all who went out to the gate of the city. Okay, so they were convinced. Again, they looked at the Israelites and said, man, we're going to be a lot better off once this is over. They're wealthy. Think of if, you know, when big corporations want to build a new factory or a plant. It's like I've heard on the news recently, Amazon wants to set up a second national headquarters. And I sometimes listen to the news station from Columbus because it's my hometown, and they're talking about they're considering Columbus, and cities will give them tax breaks and promise to build infrastructure. And it's almost like that. Hey, this great wealth is going to come into our community if we'll not give them a tax break or build them a road and sewers, but if we get circumcised. So they're convinced to do it. And it came to pass in verse 25, on the third day when they were in pain. And again, like I said, I don't remember being circumcised, quite fortunately. I know young babies seem to recover pretty quickly. I don't remember this being a big deal with Connor, and he's the only person I've been around that I've known. But like I said, I've heard of adults that it takes a while to recover. And some sources say not only were they in pain, but it's quite possible that they were having some fever. Remember, they didn't have proper antibiotics and all that, so some of the men might well have some infection they're dealing with. So they're weakened, and two of the sons of Jacob, doesn't mention any of the others involved, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, and yeah, they have the same mother, so they're all Leah's children here, each took a sword, came in boldly among the city, and killed all the males. I've read some sources speculating that Simeon and Levi might have had servants come with them. You know, they're wealthy, they might have servants and assistants. And we could argue maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but it seems apparent none of the other brothers came. So it's just Don and Simeon and Levi. And the town might be small enough and the men incapacitated enough that just two guys could do this. So either way, you know, they come in and they kill all the men. Verse 26, they killed Hamor and Shechem, his son, with the edge of the sword, took Dinah from Shechem's house. Here's where I made the point. Dinah hasn't been at home at this whole point. She's been there. And the sons of Jacob came. Okay, now it seems the other sons get in the action. Levi and Simeon are responsible for killing people, but maybe now the other nine brothers come in upon the slain. They plunder the city. You know, they took their sheep, their oxen, their donkeys, and what was in the city and in the field, all their wealth, all their little ones, all their wives, they took captives. So they're getting some slaves, some servants out of this. So they plunder the town, take the women and children as slaves, and take off with them. And in verse 30 is where we see Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You've troubled me, making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And since I'm few in number, they'll gather themselves together against me and kill me. I'll be destroyed, I and my household, and I." So, whereas I made the case the Israelites were probably numerous enough and strong enough to overcome the town of Shechem, they're not numerous and strong enough to take on the surrounding villages if they come to retaliate. And Jacob, unlike Simeon and Levi, is thinking more clearly. It's like, we're in big trouble if they come after us. It's kind of like, you know, say some marauding invaders come and attack the town of Goshen down the road, thinking, oh, we can take Goshen. But then the people from Batavia and Milford and Loveland all get together and chase after them. I'm not sure if that's a good analogy, but I'm trying to make the point of how why they're able to boldly do this, and then Jacob's afraid. You know, say, like, okay, we've got a victory here, but that's not all there is to it. And of course, they're still more short-sighted. Should he treat his sister as a harlot? I've got a note, I always want to make a comment. You know, even though I'm looking at different possibilities and things that could have happened, there's no way to interpret what happened here other than saying that this slaughter was unjustified and it was a horrible act. It's one of the black marks in the story of the Bible. There is nowhere does it say that God favored or endorsed what Simeon and Levi did, you know, or the deceit that was practiced. So this is a bad mark, not something we can be proud of. Yes, Emily?
Not that this like proves or disproves anything here, but in verse 19 it does say he was more honorable than all the house of his father. So We could probably take the fact that it was most likely a mutual thing between the two of them.
That's one of the things that leads me to suggest it. And I don't want to, you know, like I said, lead into something and make claims, but like I said, it's knowing the way things are with, say they're both teenagers, like I said, they get involved, whatever, and maybe one thing leads to another. And here we're saying an honorable, he wants to marry her. It's not like Amnon after he rapes his sister Tamar, that story that comes up later during the monarchy, you know. So he's wanting to do it's not the right thing, it's the right thing, the best thing in the circumstances. Yeah, Kayla? Yeah, he violated her, which implies that he forced her. Well, I'm not saying that's justified. No, it's him doing it is not honorable. I'm just saying it might have been, you know, it's worth knowing that violated could mean they weren't married, so it was a violation. That's possible, but it could be that they got cozy and, you know, and she's ready to stop and he's not, and that's still a violation. And so, and I would never say anything counter to that. So yeah, let's not present Shechem as honorable. I'm just saying the follow-up was more honorable than what Simeon and Levi did. So more honorable, but there's not much honor there. The whole thing, that's what I'm saying, this whole story is bad. You know, and there are lessons to be drawn from it, probably numerous. Charles,
later in the Torah, after God lets the Israelites out of Egypt, we notice that there is a law regarding rape and that the man was to be killed. But there's also a separate scripture that talks about. Remember, it had something to do with violation. The context there is that it was fornication, and then if there was fornication, then they were to marry. A lot of people will look at that scripture and say, look, see, God forces people that get raped to get married to their rapist. Mm. But that's not what it's saying.
Yeah, I think there's a case that says if it happens in the country, the man, basically if it happens in the city, both would be executed if there's fornication, because they say, well, she, you know, well, they're saying if it's in the city, nobody heard her cry out help, then she must have been willing. If it happens in the country, the man only would be executed, and it would be assumed that the woman did cry for help but wasn't close enough to get it. Yeah, there is a death sentence for rape, in the Bible, which, you know, to me, I think that wouldn't be a bad thing to have in modern society as well, but I'm not making the laws. So to get to the end, of course, as I mentioned, Simeon and Levi show no response. And even at the end of his life, Jacob is still remembering and upset by this. In Genesis 49, verses 5 and 7, when he's making prophecies and telling his sons what will happen to them in the last days, he mentions this incident. And he doesn't go into a lot of detail, but he mentions Simeon and Levi as instruments of cruelty and how they did this. Now, we don't read much of anything about Dinah after this. We don't know if she ever did get married and have children. And if not, then it's really sad that this ended up defining her life. But we don't know for sure that she did not get married and have children. So, and one of the things I want to make the point, the chapter break, I think, is somewhat unfortunate. Because you go into verse 35, God says, Jacob, get up and go to Bethel. It could seem like it's just randomly God saying it's time to make a move. But if you put it together, especially with what's mentioned down in verse 5, in verse 5 it says, they sojourned and the terror of God was on the cities all around them. It seems to be, you know, last we heard, Jacob is worried. I'm obnoxious. The people around here are going to come and attack us. So God steps in to save them. And he gives Jacob instructions for how to move to safety. And that's what happens. Said, arise, go to Bethel and dwell there, and make an altar to God who appeared to you when you fled from Esau, your brother. So, and as I said, in verse 5, it shows the terror of God was on the city, so they didn't pursue. So they're up at Shechem. They're going to go down to Bethel. So it's not a great distance, but in, you know, societies where people are settled and practice agriculture, it's going across the valleys or whatever and going far enough away. Apparently, of course, there's the added thing of supernatural intervention. When it says God put terror on the people, somehow he influenced them mentally so they didn't gather together and retaliate. As they're getting ready to go in verse 2, Jacob said to all his household, those who are with him, put away the foreign gods that are among you, purify your garments. Then let us arise and go to Bethel and make an altar there to God who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me in all the way I've gone. So this indicates that God had been with him in distress before. Jacob is in distress now. That's the what we kind of see. They're in a bad situation that Simeon and Levi have put them in. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods which were in their hands and the earrings in their ears. Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree. You might wonder, what foreign gods? These guys aren't idolaters, we hope. Well, we know of some. Rachel apparently still had those ones she stole from Laban. When they plundered all the people of Shechem, they might have picked up teraphim and various idols. So it's easy to believe that they could have been devoted to God and still had some of these idols around. It's also sadly possible that some within the household might not be worshiping God the way they should. And of course, they've also got servants that they've acquired. They probably own people. All this has happened, but Jacob's trying to purify them. He's drawing close to God. Let's get rid of these earrings. I was going to say, I don't know why the earrings, unless they were related to some type of foreign worship. There's nothing in the Bible that says earrings of themselves are bad or evil. But in this case, that might have been connected to some type of idolatry. So it says they journeyed, and as I mentioned in verse 5, God put a terror on the cities and they didn't pursue them. And he built an altar there and called the place Bethel, because God appeared to him when he fled from the face of his brother. So, same place that he called Bethel before. Now, there's a little side note here in verse 8. Now, Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried below Bethel under the terebinth tree. So, the name of it was called Alon Bakuth. Alon Bakuth literally means terebinth of weeping, or many scholars believe a terebinth tree is what we know of as an oak tree. So this Deborah must have been very well loved. I don't know how many times I read over that and said, oh, Deborah, you know, she's in the company. And then you stop and say, wait a minute, Rebecca's nurse? Or Rebecca is Isaac's wife? And people say, well, was she with them? Some people speculate that maybe she had come and joined them at some time in the interim. More likely that this is mentioning that sometime previously, perhaps years earlier, this Deborah had died when they were near Bethel and she was buried there. And it just happens to be mentioning now that they're there, oh, this area is also known for this particular thing, known for being where this popular person, Deborah, was buried near the oak tree. And that's not going to be the most important thing we learn in this class by any means, but so are you guys with me on that? Yeah, okay. Then God appeared to Jacob again in verse 9. When he came to Padan Aram and blessed him, God said to him, your name is Jacob, but your name shall not be called Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name. So he called him Israel. And it seems that Jacob is more diligent to go by that name later on. And God is here reminding him and confirming the promises that were earlier given to Abraham and Isaac. He says, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings will come from your body. The land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I give to you and to your descendants. Then God went up from the place where he talked to him. So Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked to him, a pillar of stone, poured a drink offering. Jacob called the name of the place where God spoke to him, Bethel. So I wanted to get to the end of that. One thing I'll note that is different here is in this promise of blessings is the first mention of a company of nations. God had earlier promised to Abraham and Isaac to make your descendants as many as the stars of heaven or as the sand of the sea. This is the first time he mentions a company of nations. I believe what that means becomes more clear when Jacob passes on that promise to Ephraim and Manasseh, his grandsons. And we've seen in prophecy, if our understanding is correct, and what I love Mr. McNeely calls the received prophetic scenario, we believe that the peoples of the United States of America are descended from Manasseh and are a great nation, and that Ephraim represents the British Commonwealth and other English-speaking nations that you could call a company of nations. Now, I do understand there are different ways you could interpret that, but that's the interpretation that we've settled on and that I do think is correct. And I'm pointing it out here, this is the first time a company of nations comes up, but it'll come up again. Okay, having said that, we'll go on. Something very important is going to happen in the next few verses. Verse 16, they journeyed from Bethel, so they spend some time in Bethel. God speaks to Jacob. Now they're moving further south. And when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath, sometimes called Ephrathah, will later be known by the name of Bethlehem, more commonly. But this is the ancient name. And Rachel labored in childbirth. She had hard labor. This is only Rachel's second time being pregnant, as far as we know. And it came to pass when she was in hard labor, the midwife said, don't fear, you'll have this son also. And so it was, as her soul was departing. Remember the word soul, ruach, her breath, her life is departing. It doesn't mean her immortal soul is wafting up to heaven, because that contradicts so much else that's in the Bible. But as she's dying is what it means, as it says, for she died, she called his name Ben-Oni, son of my sorrow. And how'd you like to be named that? Son of my sorrow. You know, your dad calls you, come here, sorrow. No, so Jacob changed it and called his name Benjamin, son of the right hand. But, of course, rather than focus on Benjamin's name, of course, the tragedy here is that Rachel died. She was buried on the way to Ephrath from Bethlehem, and Jacob set up a pillar on his grave, which is called the pillar of Rachel's grave to this day. So Rachel is not going to be buried in the cave where Abraham and Sarah are buried, where Leah will be buried. And you could say, well, why not? My understanding or my guess, because we don't have an answer, is that her death came so unexpected, they didn't have a chance to be traveling towards that place, and bodies, you know, didn't keep very long. You don't want to have a dead body laying around without getting it buried fairly soon. So as my guess would be that's why, not to impose some mark of disfavor upon her. Anyways, one of the things I like to point out on this, because it is a great tragedy, but death and childbirth for most of human history was not an uncommon thing. And that's something that actually surprised me as a historian studying history. It's in the modern era that childbirth became something that happens successfully most of the time because of modern medicine and the knowledge we have of how the human body works. But for most of human history, the two most dangerous things that anybody did in their life was first being born and second giving birth. I mean, death in childbirth or death in being born was not uncommon. So what we're seeing here is not the exception. It's the fact that all those other babies were born without losing them was an exception. So, and if you read the history, like in the early 1900s, when medicine was starting to advance, and, you know, they made some startling discoveries that helped the survival rate go right way up. I remember reading that one of the things they do sometimes if a woman was bleeding too much, it didn't want to stop, they'd pack it with dirt. It's like, you got to be kidding me. Talk about unsanitary. It shows how ignorant we were for much of our history. Of course, maybe in the ancient past, they were smarter and did know more, and then we lost understanding. And I don't want to make this a gross-out session. I don't want to take into account, you know, how this fits and why there might not have been more weeping. Anyways, we want to move on because, let's finish this story because in verse 21, Israel journeyed, pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Edar. Verse 22, it happened when Israel dwelt in that land that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. And Israel heard about it. Doesn't seem to be, you know, retribution right then, but there's going to be consequences. At this point, because Rachel has died, Bilhah is no longer a servant to Rachel. She's in the household. But this is still adultery. You know, Bilhah is considered belonging to Jacob. So Reuben committed a sin, and it's going to cost Reuben the birthright. Reuben is the eldest. He has claim to the birthright. And I think it's interesting, although it's not codified yet, later in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 15 and 16, God would give a law saying that a father cannot just give the birthright to the son of a wife he likes better, or to whichever son he likes best. It has to go to the eldest. So a father can't take the birthright away from the eldest just because he wants to. But from what we'll see, apparently if the eldest commits a crime or a sin, then they can forfeit the birthright in that way. And that's what happens with Reuben. That makes sense. And of course, Jacob will then pass it on jointly to the two sons of Joseph. So Jacob will take the birthright from Leah's eldest son and give it to Rachel's oldest son. And, you know, as I said, Reuben kind of brought that on himself. But what we see, and as is described in the next few verses, is the completion of Jacob's family. All 12 patriarchs of the tribes are now born, Benjamin being the last. So Leah had 6 sons and the daughter Dinah. Her 6, well, you've got them written here, so I can read them quickly. It's Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. Rachel had 2 sons, Joseph and Benjamin, but Joseph's part in the nation would be divided among Ephraim and Manasseh. They'll be counted as tribes in their own right. Bilhah has Dan and Naphtali, or Naphtali, depending on how you want to pronounce it, and Zilpah has Gad and Asher. Okay, we're coming to another thing that's kind of momentous, starting in verse 27. Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre, or Kirjath Arba, that is Hebron. So, got all these different names for Hebron, which is south of Jerusalem. We could speculate, this is the first time it's mentioned that Jacob is visiting Isaac since he left, you know, all those years ago. But perhaps he had visited before. Part of me wants to hope so. You separated from your parents all those years ago, you'd think as soon as you come to the land, you'd make a trip. And if that's true, maybe this is pointing out that he comes and spends time with him because we're at Isaac's end of days, so to speak. So he's going to come, and it seems he's going to stay there. And we'll see also, so does Edom, or Esau. Because in verse 28, the days of Isaac were 180 years. So Isaac breathed his last and died, was gathered to his people, being old and full of days. And we've discussed how those phrases refer to a death. And this seems, once again, like Abraham, to be the kind of death that you want, where you've lived a long, full life, and your family's around, and all your loved ones, and you come to an end. And his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. Once again, that sounds familiar. Remember when Abraham died, both of his sons, Ishmael and Isaac, buried him, indicating that Ishmael maintained a relationship with Abraham and perhaps the rest of the family, even though he wasn't always around. We've seen that Esau and Jacob had reconciled, so maybe Esau had moved into the area. He had been down here. Apparently he's back, but we're going to see in the next chapter that he'll leave again. And actually, I've got about this much space in my notes for chapter 36, because chapter 36 is an account of Esau's descendants becoming a nation before Israel. Okay, and so we're not going to read all of these difficult to pronounce names. I will mention in verse 31 of chapter 36, it does mention, these were kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the children of Israel. Which makes sense. They were there the whole time, not slaves in Egypt, and maybe they named a king pretty early. You've been going through the story of Judges, and then Israel calling for a king, and Samuel, you know, giving them God's word about having a king isn't the best thing. So Edom was well ahead of them in that. I will mention down in verse 6 and 7, Esau took his wives, his sons, daughters, all the persons of his household, his cattle, and all his animals, all his goods. He's got a lot of stuff, it seems, that he'd gained in the land of Canaan and went to a country away from the presence of his brother Jacob. For their possessions were too great for them to dwell together, and the land where they were in, as strangers, couldn't support them. Here's another familiar story. This was just like Lot separated from Abraham. Because Abraham became rich and had a lot of livestock. Lot became rich at the same time and had a lot of livestock. So they separated. Earlier, and by the way, that's in Genesis 13, which isn't hard to find. Later in Genesis 26, we saw that the Philistines had asked Isaac to move away from them because he was so rich they couldn't live together. So now the same thing happens with Jacob and Esau. Despite their competition when they were young, they both became filthy rich. Sorry, Esau, you didn't get the blessing and you sold your birthright, but you're still doing pretty good. Now, that's not to say that he wouldn't have liked to have had the birthright, and Jacob was wrong for buying the birthright the way he did. Okay, but other than that, there's a long list of all these sons and grandsons. I'm looking for one that stands out, and I don't have it. There it is. In verse 16, we see Chief Amalek. Amalek would be, I believe, a grandson of Esau who is going to be the forebearer of a nation known as the Amalekites. And of course, they're prominent in interdealing with the history of Israel. And I noticed that word chiefs. I still like the old King James used the word duke, which I don't know. I remember reading it as a kid saying, did they have dukes back then? Apparently not. The Hebrew is aluf, A-L-L-U-W-P-H. And it means chieftain, it can mean governor, it can even in some cases in the context be translated as a bull, although these guys weren't necessarily being called bulls. But so Esau separates, they become this nation. We'll see them in prophecy, we'll see them fighting with Israel and Judah at times and cooperating at other times. And then after the feast, we're going to pick up with chapter 37. Part of the reason I'm rushing through 36 is because chapter 37 begins the story of Joseph. And it's one of the great dramatic stories in the Bible. I would say one of the great dramatic stories of mankind. It's one of the top stories as far as drama and plot twists and all that. But that's going to be afterwards. For now, we want to take a break.